Okay, I think we're ready to begin our city council meeting since the hour of 6:30 has arrived. Maybe they're not. I'll just talk loud because it's on. Oh, are they now? Okay. Now we're good. Thank you, everyone, for coming out this evening for our city council meeting for August 12th, 2026. Time is now, it's still 6:30, so we did. All right, getting the mics up. Excellent. We are holding our council meeting at the Manti City Building, 50 South Main. And we have today almost a full crew. A.J. Maurer is absent, excused, and our city manager is at the rural water meetings. He's on the board, and so he is having McKay fill in for him this evening. Megan Johnson, Mary Pipes, Jen Christiansen, and Brian Francois are here, as well as myself and reporter Matt Gray. And McKay, who we mentioned, will be standing in for Jason. To begin this evening, Mary Pipes will offer our prayer, and then Brian Francois will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Our Father in heaven, we're so very blessed to be living in this beautiful town and this beautiful country. Thankful for the opportunity we have to meet as a mayor, city council, and the wonderful citizens of Manti this evening to discuss the business of Manti City. We pray that Thy Spirit will guide us as we consider the options in front of us, that we will make the best and the wisest decisions for everyone in the city. We are grateful for the rains that we have received, grateful for the firemen who are out fighting the wildfires in our area, and we do pray for their safety and for the comfort of those who have been lost. We pray now that Thy Spirit will be with us as we go through this evening. Be with those who are not here this night, that they will also be blessed. We love thee so very much, and we say these things in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Please rise for the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. The first item on our council agenda today, if you want to scooch that up, McKay, if you can, is the declaration of conflicts of personal interest. If anyone has anything that they need to declare on the agenda today, please make it known.
I don't know if it's a conflict of interest, but just so everyone knows, I am on the Historic Preservation Commission.
I think that's sort of an assignment. So
well,
thank you. Thank you for bringing it up. Our second item is the approval of recent council meeting minutes from July 15th, 2026. Has anyone noted any additional corrections that are needed on the minutes? Excellent. I will then accept a motion to approve the minutes for July 15th, 2026.
I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes from July 15th.
I'll second that.
Motion made by Brian Francois, seconded by Jen Christiansen. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Next item is the approval of payment report, the bills that we'll need to sign at the conclusion of our council meeting today. Are there any questions on those bills or any items that you want to discuss?
I'm really glad that we use as many local businesses as we do. When I see who we have gotten things from, it's good that we use whenever possible, we are using local businesses.
Thanks for bringing that up, Mary, because it is important, and hopefully we all make an effort to support our local businesses because it helps with our own tax base so that we don't have to increase other taxes as much. All right, and given that, I will accept a motion for the payment of the bills following our meeting this evening.
I'll make a motion to pay the bills at the meeting. I'll second that motion.
Motion made by Jen Christiansen and seconded by Megan Johnson. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes, so we'll take care of that following the meeting. The next item is regarding our 2027 municipal elections. And I believe we have an expert to explain things to us. Heather, thank you.
You're welcome. Cool, I'm glad you have that.
This is regarding the draft 27 interlocal cooperation agreement between San Pete County and Manti City. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I didn't even recommend my time coming, so you get the call. Okay, so my name is Heather Piper, and I am San Pete County's election specialist, also deputy clerk to Linda Christiansen. She's the county clerk. If you're not aware what the county clerk handles, we do ground requests, marriage licenses, business licenses, passports. We also do meeting and agenda clerking for the county commissioners and the planning commission, and then my personal favorite is elections. Well, Linda came into the office almost 4 years ago. One of the highest priorities for her was to build a stronger, more direct connection with our municipal leaders, but more specifically with our city recorders. Under Utah law, our city recorders serve as the official election officers of the municipal elections. She is the election officer for the county. The recorders carry the responsibility of local governance right at the grassroots levels. Today, I'm here to discuss our updated interlocal election agreement, walk through what upcoming 2027 municipal election cycle will look like, and highlight why active municipal involvement is essential to running secure, accurate, and transparent elections across San Pete County. First, we'll go over the interlocal agreement. The updated local agreement has not really changed much from the past years. The cost per voter did increase, and clarification of responsibilities have been enhanced. County Commission and the County Attorney have approved the draft in the County Commission meeting. We encourage you to review the document with your City Attorney, and if you have any suggestions, feedback, or adjustments that need to be evaluated, the final agreement will be sent via DocuSign sometime in December of this year for your approval, so please get your feedback back to us by April of 2027. For those of you that have a copy, can you please turn to Exhibit B? All right, so this is just the estimated cost per election. As you review this, you'll see that the base election administration fee is $4 per registered voter for each election. I want to be completely transparent. The cost of administering an election is far more than just $4 per registered voter. The cost of administering elections is for secure ballot printing and return postage to specialized equipment, maintenance, licensing, and state-mandated security audits. They have risen across the board drastically. A rate of $4 per voter does not even cover the cost that the county administers each election. By partnering with the county, your city avoids having to purchase hundreds of thousands of dollars in optical tabulators, high-speed scanners, or specialized voting machines. The county handles the heavy technical lift, such as printing and mailing ballots, managing signature verification, tabulating votes, and conducting post-election audits. As of right now, Manti currently has 2,034 active registered voters. And over the past five election cycles, Manti has held the primary election in 21, 23, and in 25. and the general elections of 17, 19, 21, 23, and 25. So looking ahead to the 2027 municipal elections, we want your council to be prepared to budget accurately. Primary elections in our county municipalities are only triggered when candidate filings exceed twice the number to the open seats. Historically, most MP counties, cities only hold a general election. However, if you were to have a contested race with three or more candidates for a single open seat, a primary will occur, incurring the rate of the $4 per registered voter. Just a budgeting tip, we just strongly suggest that you put in a primary in your budget, as if you are going to have a primary in the 27 election. While the county manages the ballot processing, the high-tech infrastructure of a successful election is impossible without the active participation from our city reporters and local officials. We are here to support you in every step of the way, but city involvement slips, strict critical statutory steps, and chain of custody protocols cannot be compromised. Specifically, we need your leadership in four key areas: poll worker training and involvement, we need city reporters and potentially additional city staff or election officials to participate directly in our poll worker and election security trainings, ballot pickup and delivery. Under the interlocal agreement, it's the city's responsibility to pick up and deliver ballots. We do not take the chain of custody or ballot security lightly. Only trained individuals are authorized to perform ballot pickup and delivery duties. Your direct involvement here is critical to protecting the integrity of the vote. Statutory public notices and disclosures. Recorders remain responsible for posting local candidate filing windows, ballot review, sample ballots, and election notices on the Utah Public Notice website, as well as collecting candidate financial disclosures, conflict of interest statements, and regarding ballot review, the city official will verify that it was printed to and met state code and will sign off an affidavit stating this ballot has been approved. Also, updating elected official changes. So throughout the year, not just during election, you will have city council change, mayors change, just as in like Fayette, Jeff Bartholomew. When those vacancies become updated, they need to be, he has access to a Google Doc. Those need to be updated immediately so that we are able to update the state's website and everything. When you stay actively involved and trained, protect your municipality from legal changes, security risks, and administrative delays. You are never on an island in this process. Our countywide network of city recorders is a wonderful resource. If you are ever unsure about a deadline or disclosure rule, lean on your neighboring recorders. Peer support across Adobe County is one of our greatest strengths. And I will say, Candace in Ephraim and Lacey in Centerville are amazing people to lean on if you have questions. They are awesome. I also strongly encourage all reporters to participate in the Lieutenant Governor's office. It's called Roundtable. It's a portal that connects you with the state election officials and reporters across the state of Utah to stay current on law changes and best practices. Today, I'm providing you with a copy of the 2025 election calendar. I think Mary has one. So this is what it looks like. Actually, I don't know if Mary has one. Matt has one though. This is what it looks like. Green is municipal, orange is us, and then the blanks are just either both of us combined or the LG's office. And this just states every date on here and a state code connected to it on what is happening that day, deadlines, all the stuff. The first day on this calendar is actually January 1st, and then goes through the 15th. It also includes vital state code references. I strongly encourage the reporter to use these references to follow upcoming legislative sessions, as any legislative changes can directly impact local election timelines. As many of you know, deadlines in the world of elections aren't suggestions, they are statutorily required and mandates. Taking canvas election results, for example, most cities prefer to canvas during a regularly scheduled city council meeting. However, state code strictly dictates that a caucus cannot happen sooner than 7 days after the election and no later than 14 days after an election. That gives us a tight window of just 1 week. Because of this adjustment should be made, shouldn't be made last minute. When you set your annual meeting at the beginning of the year, we suggest that you post it to the public notice website, take a look at your election timeline, and adjust your meeting schedules accordingly to that election, so you're not having to do a special meeting just for your campus. If you refer to the executive summary that I handed each of you, please notice the key 2027 deadlines. Your primary election is going to be in August, and the general election is November 2nd, 27. This teamwork yields real results. Our San Pete County Elections Office was recently recognized by the Lieutenant Governor's Office as one of the five counties statewide to receive an award at the state capitol for the excellence in elections communications, best practices for voter education, and outreach and accessibility. That recognition belongs to our entire election team and the municipal reporters who partner with us. It shows us that even in a rural county, we can set state standards for clean, accessible, and secure elections. With that being said, I'd like to take a moment to discuss your city reporter. We sincerely appreciate the support over the past two elections and his attendance at our most recent training. Next year marks his first election, leading Manti, and we want to ensure he has total support to thrive and succeed. To make that happen, active participation in all upcoming county trainings and prompt, steady communication with our office will be essential. That this is his election, and our goal is to partner with him to ensure a seamless process. We deeply value our partnership with every city in San Pete County. We are here to help guide you, but we do need your active seat at the table. Starting with training and ballot security. Thank you for your service in our community, and I'm happy to answer any questions about our interlocal agreement training schedules for the 2027 budget projection.
I have one question.
Yes.
On number 10, it says counterparts. This agreement may be executed and counterparts by the city and the county. Can you just explain what that means? I tried to look it up to find it. It's just the number 10.
Page 6.
And I get the feeling that it means both of us can do it, but I don't understand exactly what that is.
Yes, no, that's exactly it. And in this interlocal agreement, it does state that the city is responsible for certain things and the county is responsible
okay.
for certain things.
Okay,
yes, got it. Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
What was the cost in the past?
I know it's gone up.
Yes, it has. It was, so Manti was everybody was $2.25 per voter, and it went up to $4 per voter.
Yeah,
postage
went up.
Yeah,
postage already.
And I've kind of lost track of what the legislature has done and what they passed and what they were hoping to pass. Is Manti City going to have their own ballot boxes when they have a municipal election? Or will we be able to use the county drop box? Or how is that going to work?
So right now, Manti's drop box is the one that's at the county courthouse.
Okay.
If wanted, we do have an extra little ballot box that could go inside an office that can be locked and secured in there.
But that would need two poll workers there when it's open. Is that how that would work?
No, because it's on camera. So just having
it on camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Considered.
Because you're not. No one's necessarily touching the ballot.
Okay.
You're just dropping the ballot off. In the
okay.
But yes, people are just like. But everybody knows that the county has the ballot box. So I can't imagine that you'd have a lot of people dropping off here.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions?
I have one question.
Okay.
So I don't know what the situation is this year, but if you had a situation where there is a winner of a primary election and there are no other candidates from any other parties, do you still have to have a general election?
Are you talking like a county election? Because municipal elections are nonpartisan.
So
like right now, like AJ, for example, has no one running against him as of right now, because the writing deadline hasn't passed yet. So as of right now, yes, AJ will be on the general ballot, along with like Linda will be on the general ballot, Kevin Daniels will be on it, Jim Cheney will be on it. So, yes, there will be a general.
Okay.
Yep.
Any other? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I would say for anyone who has not been to the clerk's office to see the process of elections, if they're concerned about the safety and security, it's unbelievable what you guys do. So I would encourage everybody when they get an opportunity to go in and talk to you about how you do it and how the process works, because it was amazing when I went and looked at it.
Thank you. We take pride in that.
Yeah, thanks for setting a good example for all the state.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you. All right, the next item is a discussion of the Urban Deer Removal Program renewal. And we have some representatives from DWR here.
Good evening. I'm Rod Nielsen. I am the Central Region Wildlife Bio-1 over Urban Deer Program. I've got with me our Wildlife Manager, Dave Spendley, is here with me to make sure that I don't screw up. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Now, I wasn't quite sure. I guess, do you just have questions about the COR or the program or anything that I can answer? Or I didn't really present or plan a presentation, but I'm here to answer questions if so needed.
So I have a question about the active dates. Says August 1st to October 31st, we can take 50 deer per year within Manchester city limits. Is there what is the process to extend that date from October 31st to say November 30th or something like that?
To increase the removal days. Okay, so we're pretty set on the cutting it off on October 15th.
Because
and the reason why is
October 31st.
Pardon?
October 31st. It says October 31st. Right there.
Yeah. Okay. That was not supposed to be that way. I'm just making sure.
Halloween is a big hunting night, though.
I don't know how that got changed. I had the last time I'd seen it, we had the October 15th cutoff date on that. So we probably are going to have to readdress that and change that to that should have read October 15th is the cutoff date.
And what's the reasoning for that?
The reasoning is so this whole program is designed to remove what we call urban deer, residential deer that are born and raised and live in town year-round. What we have discovered over the years is when we first implemented this program back in 2012, I believe, at that time we allowed removals to go from August 1st to December 31st. That's when deer can be removed. What we found by about that time, collar data started to come into play with animals tracking. You know, we put GPS collars on them.
Yeah.
And what we discovered is after about the middle of October is when we start getting the migration of mountain deer that come down into the cities. We want to remove the urban deer and the city deer, and if we go past about the 15th of October, we run the risk of. So the mountain deer, the wild deer, they come down in October or November, you know, for the migration. They'll spend the winter down here, and then they go back up on the mountains. Those are the deer that we do not want to remove because
they know what they're doing.
Yeah, right. And the difference between the two different deer is the deer that are born and raised here, this is their home. This is all they know. They don't know the mountains. They don't know the foothills. And so we're trying, that's the deer that we're trying to lower the numbers on, manage the population of those. The migratory deer, the deer that do it the way they're supposed to, they've been doing it for eons, and that's what we want to continue to do. So that's why we regulate that cutoff date you know, and make it shorter. You know, we've got some cities, Eagle Mountain or Elk Ridge, for instance, they're in the program, and we only allow them to remove deer for the month of August, and that's it. Then we cut them off, just because their proximity to the foothills is a lot better, or a lot more there. So that is the reason why we end the removals.
Do we know how many urban deer we have in the city of Manti, a rough estimate?
I believe I seen the estimate they came up with was 200. And that's really a hard number to come up with, because when you go out and do your counts, you know, usually when they do these, the best time to count deer is at night. You know, that's when they come out. It's easier to see with spotlights and that. But did you count this group, and then did they switch while you're moving, and did you count them again? So it's more based on the number of complaints that you get from residents, and you know, the issues that people have with the urban deer.
Do 50 deer generally each year get taken out?
No. I believe
five.
Yeah.
And why is that?
Because they're smart.
It's difficult. It's hard to. So the way that Manti has been doing it the last few years is live trapping them, and it's called a clover trap. It's a live trap. As you can imagine, trying to get any wild animal to go into a cage,
right,
is pretty difficult. So there's a lot of man hours that go into catching deer, and it can be done, but it's a difficult task.
Aren't there archery tags that are tied in with this too? I thought I heard that.
No, not with this program. Okay. So the city can, the two options that the city has is you can either use the trapping method, you know, a live trap, or if you so wished, you could find a private contractor or somebody that removes them with archery equipment, but that would be the city's decision to do that. When the program first started, the majority of the animals that were removed lethally were done by a archery contractor that they did that. They had pretty good success with it, but the reason that they don't do it anymore is they had a big problem with the dates that we set out to them to remove deer. They wanted to wait later into the year because it's easier to remove them at that point. So they have since gone up, they don't do it anymore. So all the cities that are left in the program are all doing the live trapping and removing them that way. And that's the method that I urge cities to look at. Anytime you have somebody that's shooting archery equipment inside a city limits, you know, they were careful. I don't know that they had any major problems, accidents, or anything like that. By going with the live trapping, you pretty much eliminate the liability issue with archery equipment.
At five deer, though, that's already putting a dent in the issue.
It's just one of those that is what you guys decide to do, you know. Depending on the actual numbers and that, you might not even keep up with the rate of replenishing on them, but a lot of cities use this to not so much control the population, but to try and help residents and citizens out with certain problems that they have in their neighborhoods. You know, in other cities I've seen where for the majority of the towns, they have very few deer, but they'll have certain spots throughout that town where deer seem to congregate and cause a group of residents or a neighborhood or something a lot of grief, and that's where they concentrate their efforts.
So if outside of these times, I've had at least one citizen contact me about an aggressive deer that's been hanging out in their yard. like she would go to let her dogs out and the deer would be there and it was getting aggressive towards her and towards her dogs. What would be the best thing for people to do if that happens outside of August 1st?
So if you have an aggressive deer, they can call the division and we can come out and, you know, we make a case by case. You know, if there's, you know, what will happen, especially there's two times of the year that deer will typically be a little bit more aggressive. That's in the fall when the bucks are going to rut.
Right.
They tend to be not want to be messed with, you know, left alone. And then the other time that we get calls on aggressive deer is in the springtime when the does start dropping their fawns. And a lot of times, you know, if they'll call and talk to us, we can come out and look at it individually. A lot of times it's just mostly, it's probably got a fawn, you know, if you give it a little bit of space and allow them to let the fawn get to where they can get it and move it, you know, though it usually goes away. But if there's a public safety issue, they can call us and then we can look at it individually and assess it from that point.
Okay. And sometimes we just don't know what the process is and who to contact.
Right.
I was going to ask, is it accurate that the resident deer are not at all healthy because they're not eating the right stuff?
Yes, they're not in near the condition as the wild deer because they're not eating the right diet that the deer should eat. You know, they're roses, tomato plants. It's not, you know, deer are browsers, so. They can eat it, and they've been eating it their whole life. They can survive on it. They can get by on it. But as far as a healthy deer, they're not healthy. When we were at the beginning of the program, we were trapping and relocating and doing lethal removal. And when we trapped, when you trap a deer, it was pretty easy to determine if it was a wild deer or if it was an urban deer, just body conditions. Muscle, fat on them, there's a pretty good distinction between the two of them.
Is there any concern with your department that, I mean, in a rural community like this where you have a deer population, is replenishing at a greater rate than when they're being removed? They're in a situation in a habitat where they really have no predator, right? Except for Jason's GMC truck.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, it's a problem that's just going to exponentially get worse, right?
That's
right. More people come in, more plants, gardens, things like that, you know, it's just going to perpetuate. Is there a feeling that maybe something a little bit more drastic needs to be done in order to try to put a dent in the situation?
Yeah, so, you know, going forward, I mean, if you're looking at trying to remove more deer from the landscape, the best way to do that would be to increase the number of traps that you have out. I'm not sure how many mantis use in the last few years. I think they were using 5 or 6 possibly.
3 or 5, yeah.
You know, so the more you put out on the landscape, the more chances, better chances you have of catching deer and removing more of them that way. But you're right, about the only predator they have is
cars.
So do you have any suggestions for the citizens that are in town? I mean, I've got everything I don't want them to eat pretty much just fenced off.
Sure.
The best thing for people to do if they have landscape they don't want disturbed. They came and picked all my tomatoes that were on the plant that was right next to my.
Let me guess, they only take one bite out of one tomato and then they move to the next.
They left 3 of the green ones that way. The red ones, it was kind of an experiment because it was literally right next to my front door. I'm like,
sure.
So how close will they be? Yeah, they'll come right up next to your door.
So, yes, fencing an 8-foot fence around what you want protected is. Guarantee to keep deer out.
Okay.
That's 100%. But with the understanding that can be expensive, it can, you know, might not be.
It's awkward.
So the spiel or the talk that I give to people, and I get a lot of calls, just about weekly of people with you know, complaining, concerns about the deer in their gardens, eating their gardens, their plants, their bushes. There's a lot of things out on the market that people swear that work. It's the electronics stuff. There's the flashing lights. There's hanging soap. Human hair. I've listened to all of them, and I've looked at all of them, and none of them, as I know, any of them work. They might work in individual cases, but it's not something that I'd say, yeah, use this. The only thing that I can give you suggestion on with deer in your yard is there's an item out there. It's called a scarecrow sprinkler. It's a regular sprinkler. Well, it's a designed sprinkler for this purpose, but it has a motion sensor on it. So you hook your hose up to it, you turn the water on, you stick it in your yard. 24/7 it works. If something comes in and breaks that beam, it sprays, and they're designed to be a little bit louder than regular sprinklers. So it's not so much them getting sprayed that scares them, it's that sudden spray. Startling, you know, that'll do it. That works really well. I've recommended that for quite a few years. I've had several people that have called me back after and saying that was amazing, that was great. There are a couple of secrets and tricks to using those. You get these, you know, and people, depending on how big of an area you're trying to protect, you might want to put two or three of them, put them in tandem. But the biggest secret is do not put them, just don't stick them and forget them. It's not like the Ronco, don't set it and forget it, you know. Go out and move it every couple, 2 or 3 days, and move it even 10 feet or a different angle or whatever. Because deer are very, they have habits. And they, you know, a deer will get up and it'll go down the same path every morning at the same time. You know, it'll go the same way. So what the idea is when you're dealing with deer that are causing you problems is you want to try and break that cycle. And it won't happen overnight. It takes some diligence to keep on it. But if you keep messing that, working that up and messing them up and not letting them figure out where it's at, eventually over time, those deer will move. They'll change your habits and they'll go somewhere else.
And it's really important to turn it off before your wife walks through the yard.
Yeah, or at least tell her. Yeah.
That happens with them.
So that right there is, you know, and the other suggestions I tell people is, you know, I'll be talking to somebody and they'll be on the phone with me and they'll stop and I'll say, oh, then damn deer are right there under my voice. They're just don't let the deer be comfortable. You know, they don't like to be bothered. They like to be left alone in peace. You know, they're lounging out. So every time you see them out there underneath your trees or in your garden or whatever, go out, run them off. You know, bang the pots and pans, throw rocks at them, spray them with the hose. You know, and like I say, you know, people will do it and they do it a couple of times and it doesn't work, but it's that consistency, doing it every single time. If I'm fortunate to, well, I don't know if it's fortunate, but where I live in Spanish Fork, and the neighborhood that we live in, we live far enough in that we don't have deer, but I always tell people, I would guarantee you that if I had deer in my yard that I didn't want there, they would be terrified of me. Then if I come around the bend, the last turn into home, they'd be on their way. No, because they're like, no, it's about to start, you know. So, and like I say, these are not surefire anything, but in a combination of all of them together, you can start to see results.
Okay, we didn't used to have a problem.
No, we didn't.
About 15 years ago, yeah. Things just started building and building and building.
Well, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. And I've talked to other people in other cities. Springville was one of them. I went to a city council meeting there, and the lady stood up and she says, I've lived in Springville for 35 years, and we never had this many deer in Springville. And partially true, but partially it's not true. What happened 35 years ago is And I'm sure it's the same thing with manti. Manti was 35 years ago was probably half the size it is now. Or I don't know. I'm just putting numbers out there. But you had a lot more undeveloped ground. Every time you build a house or you develop a piece of ground, you're tightening that space up for deer. So I think with Springville, they've always had deer out, but they've been spread out in a larger area. But as Springville develops and lot after lot after lot gets developed, and you're just tightening that space. So all of a sudden, you had 100 deer spread out over 50 acres, and now they're comprised into 20 acres, So. I think the numbers, I don't know that we have any data that would really show that, but that's what I suspect is it's not so much more deer, it's just that they're being compressed.
So in terms of this renewal, it's not that we have to put it into play, but if we need to,
we can.
You have the option. Yes.
Whereas if we don't renew, then we don't have the option.
That is correct. So there's nothing in there, nothing that says that if you don't renew deer, we're going to come and threaten you. It's just so that you have the authority and the option that if you want to, you can do it.
We want you to get Delta Force and come in.
Well, if you go back. I've done a little bit of reading in that, and back east, there's some communities back there that kind of do that. They'll hire private contractors that specialize in using suppressed firearms, and they all decked out. Because back east, if you think that we got a lot of deer, there's cities back there that are just overrun with the whitetail, and there's a lot of problems back there.
Any other questions from any of you?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For your information and for what you do.
Sure, thank you. And if you have any further questions down the road, just be sure and give me a holler, and I'll be glad to help you out.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So with the proposal to renew, I guess we need to check a date on that, but I think we can still accept a motion to renew the program to give us the option, and then we'll have it available if we choose to use it. So I will accept a motion to renew the program.
All right, I'll make a motion that we renew the Urban Deer Removal Program.
I second that.
Motion made by Brian Francois and seconded it by Mary Pipes. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes. We'll check and get
okay.
That.
And I will check on
the date.
I'll talk to we'll find out about the date on that and we'll get that straight. I apologize for that. But as long as you have your meeting and you approve it and everything, then we can proceed from there.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you again for.
Sorry, I didn't mean to walk out. I thought you were done. No. So.
and don't run into any deer since it's now getting close to dusk time on your way home.
No, I would live that one down. Okay. Happy and I thank you.
Thank you. Actually, do get a deer.
Yeah. Oh, there you go with the removal program. All right, the next item on our agenda is the monthly financial report. And McKay, will you take care of that for us, please?
I'll do what I can. All right, so just as a reminder for everybody, we're 1 month into the budget year, so that's about 8% of the year so far. So that's just helpful as we go through these numbers, if you understand. Since I am not Jason, I will not be going over every number, but you can see it up here. And I'll at least go through what the notes he gave me.
Great.
So I'm only going to go over mostly the year-to-date, that green column. You can see here, this is general fund. We're at total revenues of about 84,000 for the general fund. As I scroll down, we can see expenses for the general fund as well. I'll slowly go through, but I'll show you the bottom total. So we've got a total of 306,000 here. This is for expenses. Also, we're always over in expenses for the first 6 months of the year, once things start to flow through these numbers even out. And then we'll go down to special revenue, nothing on that right now. And I'm going to check the enterprising funds, which, did I skip that?
Yeah.
I did, sorry. Enterprising here is in the black for the same reasons, just for the first 6 months, usually that's how it goes. Any questions?
I don't think so.
All right, we'll get an abbreviated one this time.
Great, thanks. All right, the next item on the agenda is Recreation Director Luke Rowley to speak with us about the Duncan Hill proposals.
I'm just as still as a mouse for a minute. Perfect. So the proposal that I have, we received a grant for $5,000 it's been a year and a half ago. We were supposed to finish the grant up last year, but we pushed it off just because we were trying to come up with a better location for the disc golf course, that kind of stuff. This year, we've got a proposal for you to put it on Duncan Hill. As soon as McKay pulls those pictures up, I'll go over with you. But while I'm waiting for him, a couple things that I want to talk about. We have a company, it's a nonprofit company called Elevate Utah. They've helped design several big courses. For example, they designed the course that the women's national USA team just came and played in Utah. Up in, where was that, Matt?
Brighton.
Up in Brighton.
It was the U.S. Women's Disc Golf Championship. It was a major for professional disc golf.
Yeah, so this company that we're working with has designed courses like that. So, and they've actually, so our grant's for $5,000. They actually helped me get 17 baskets already donated to us, which is worth about $5,000 to $6,000 all by itself. And so a couple things about disc golf. It's kind of like a regular golf course. So if you look right here, you can see your opening kiosk has all of your holes laid out for you. And then each hole has its own little, has a basket on it like this. They'll have tee pads. These are just some examples from different courses around. So a tee pad usually looks like this. For this year, we wouldn't do concrete. We would want to do turf so that we can actually move them depending on the bicycle trails that we put in and the traffic, just see how it flows, that kind of stuff. And then after the first year, we'd go back in and put in concrete pads. So that would be a different phase to it. This year, we would be doing 9 holes, not the whole 18, but they would actually design the full 18 for up there on Duncan Hill. It would start down, I call it the parking lot, over just east of the temple on 300 east. There's that little flat spot that looks like a parking lot. That's where we're talking about starting it. It would go up to hole number 1, and then hole number 2 would get you clear up on top. So those first 2 holes would be tough holes. And then after that, you're up on top where all the views are. And so a couple other things that we've talked about with them is they would design the course for us. They would do all the signage for us, create the signs, and I'll get to some of those. Go the wrong way. So here's an example of one of the signs that they built for another city. And so it shows where your tee box is, shows where the basket is, with actual trees and everything that would be in that location. And they've already come down and spent about 10 hours down here already walking Duncan Hill to make sure that it would be a good enough course that we could hold tournaments and different things like that to help bring in some revenue that way. But it's also open up for the public just to go up and use it any time as well.
And so, and I'll tell you another reason why I want to use them. If you, do we have any disc golfers out of you guys? Have you been over to Ephraim's course?
Several times.
Okay, and do you like it?
It's a pretty rugged course. It's a
really rugged course because they haven't done a good job of maintaining the trails. Their tee boxes, the signs are at the front of the tee boxes. We went and played it the other day. That's why I know that. So it's in your way. So basically they have somebody in their city over there, I don't know if they're a rec director or parks or who it was, just go in and design it because they've probably played a little bit of disc golf. But it's not really an efficient course. Like, and they've already redesigned it three times. So that's why I want a professional to come in and help us out the first time. So here's some more just things that they've done. Elevate Utah. So kiosks. So just kind of going the wrong way again. This mouse is backwards from my mouse.
You're giving me a flash.
Yeah. So they come in, they've had artists come in and paint different areas, different things like that. So just a huge help for us. And that would take our $5,000 to have them design the course and to have them build the signs. Each sign is about $100 each, and then for the bigger signs are about $500. So you're talking $1,500 in signage. They design the course and they'll help build the course with us. And so they're pretty much working for free when you think of the man hours that they're putting into it. Like I said, they've already put in 10 hours. They've already got 10. I mean, they've already got us about $5,000 worth of baskets donated to us, that kind of stuff. The only catch I do have is we've got to move on it quickly because I have to have it finished by about mid-October and all my paperwork turned in. And so that's why I'm asking for you guys to approve that area, to have a disc golf there. They also are willing to work with us with the bicycle paths that we've already kind of have ideas for. So, because part of their thing is they don't want a lot of their traffic where it'll tear up the bicycle tracks as well. So they're pretty conscious of everything involved in making sure that that hill is treated right and that we have an awesome disc course.
So it could be used for more than one thing. It could be used for more than just disc golf.
Oh, yeah.
The $5,000?
No.
The $5,000 has to be used just
for. But we could still have bike trails up there and walking trails.
Yeah, so the walking trails and the disc golf trails actually go hand in hand because we want nice trails to be able to get to the baskets and that kind of stuff.
Okay, so I have never played disc golf. How do you play disc golf?
So you take a frisbee and you're on that tee off box.
Don't call it a frisbee.
Yeah.
Disc.
I knew she would understand frisbee. So you're standing here and you are launching your disc clear out. Up in here.
So you're usually trying to get a hole in one?
No. I got basketball sometimes gets holes in one. For me, it's like I'm good if I get a bar.
So you throw it and then you walk to it.
Yeah, you walk to it. Usually they're about par three, par four course.
Okay.
We do have some amazing shots on our spot where they can do some of those longer shots where it would be a par four, a little more challenging. And oh, the other thing with this company, I mentioned they will design all 18 holes, so the whole plan is all together. And on the kiosk, it'll show the first 9 holes as being in place, and then it'll have kind of dotted lines where the next phase 2 will be. And that way, when it's time to put in the phase 2, we put it in, and we can use the same kiosk sign. We don't have to redesign it.
The real disc, you throw the disc and then you spend the next hour looking for it in the search for safe.
Yes, I have played golf. That concept.
Pull up a basket up there. So what you're doing is you're going to that basket. The basket has chains that hang down.
Uh-huh.
So when the disc hits the chains, it actually envelops it and then drops it in there. So that way you know you're in the hole, basically.
Okay.
So, Lou, you're talking about the $5,000 grant.
Correct. And we've already we have to do a matching percent of 30% of that, but a lot of that can be an 8-9, which we've already got because of the baskets.
Okay.
So we'd probably be about $1,000 at the most to do this project.
For 9?
For 9, yeah.
$1,000?
Yeah. So it would be to design 18, but to finish 9.
But did I read that the city crew is responsible to construct the course? Did I read that right? Or
and volunteers.
Labor.
And volunteers.
And volunteers. Okay.
And the company also.
They will be helping
you. I would figure, like, my seasonal help is who I would, well, they're done for the year, so probably not them. But we would have, like, I'd get volunteers to come in and help, and that also counts towards our in-kind match, but we don't really need it because we're way over on our in-kind match. So
there are enthusiasts who would, no problem, drop everything and go in there and help.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like pretty balls. Very popular.
Yeah. Right back there is one of them. He's got all his kids signed up to already help to do this project. And so, yeah, come on up.
I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Justin Jenkins. I teach sixth grade over at the middle school in Ephraim, but I live here in Manti. I've been playing disc golf since 2012. But to answer the question, it's like golf. You start at the tee, least amount of shots to get into the basket, right, that kind of thing. But I've talked to quite a few people in the community that have already said that they would be willing to volunteer for the work to help us put in. A number of people, we've got disc golf baskets in the Ephraim Middle School now that they're teaching disc golf in eighth grade PE that they're starting this year. A lot of kids, I teach it in my class, I show them things and stuff. So the kids are getting enthused about it as well. They just need a place to do it.
Unlike real golf, this is something that anybody, any kid, that knows how to throw a disc can do. I mean, it may take them 10 shots to get into the basket, but it's not necessarily the skill level, it's the getting out there with your family and other friends and things and being involved.
It's a very good thing. I've seen play tournaments and things with kids from as young as 8, 9 years old to people in their 60s and 70s that play. So
okay, so let's circle on back to parking.
So parking, we would look down at the bottom of that hill, right where that flat
right,
spot
and
is.
I know where that is, and there's not a lot of space there. How many row is a problem?
Yeah.
The what?
The road, the dirt road.
That would be something we would have to address, is that road, for sure.
That I think that would be a bigger problem than anything else would be parking in the road.
Uh-huh. I agree with that.
If I may.
That's so.
That will be included in hopefully our larger plans for trails and parks, and so great. It's going to happen with or without the disc golf.
Okay. So, the parking.
Yeah, okay. The parking.
So. Well, I know. Just mentioned one more thing. Yeah, I'm up at Bregan Ski Resort. They have a disc golf course there that they just held a big event at. They also have mountain bike trails there, and they work together very, very well. And Elevate Utah designed that course around those mountain bike trails as well. So they've had experience with that in the past also.
Yep. Okay. Any other questions? I think the biggest benefit is it'll get families out together.
Exactly.
And so.
Thanks for the information.
No other questions? Okay, and like I said, we've got to move on quick because otherwise we're just throwing away the $5,000. So, okay? Thank you.
Thank you.
And you guys know when I'll hear back from you, Rob. Not that I'm chomping at the
bit. What did you say your deadline was? October?
Mid-October, it's got to be finished. Like all my paperwork and everything has to be in. So,
realistically,
the end of September, I've got to have this golf.
Everything finished, like the course?
Yeah.
Never done.
Why?
No, the paperwork.
By end of September, early October, I've got to have it finished.
What? The paperwork or the course?
The course. I can't do the paperwork until the course is done.
Oh, okay.
So, I got to send them pictures of everything.
What happens if you violate that deadline?
We already did. We got an extended 1 year already. So
you lose the money.
So we just lose $5,000.
Yeah.
So
in the middle of our project,
we're not in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well, but if you were.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. That's a tight deadline. So you
better
have your
doll
in here.
Oh, it's very tight.
You're showing your strength. I love it.
And you should know about how we're going to have your deadline. So.
Yeah, I think that's our biggest concern, Luke, is the labor part.
Yeah.
Our city staff.
I'm not planning on using the city workers for it. I'm planning on using myself and the company and volunteers.
Okay.
So I'm not planning on Corey's guys doing the trails.
I have a lot of friends that I played this off when I lived in Provo and stuff that I know they're chomping at the bit. Like you said, the enthusiasts will chomp. They'll come down and help too.
There's
that's
no
money
loss
spent in our city, by the way.
There's no loss to the city if we say yes. You know what I'm
saying? Well, there's $1,000 lost that you'll have to come up with $1,000.
Well, I'm
Well,
I mean, it's on you.
I'll make it back for you through the term.
It's all record. It's all record. My biggest concern was being able to have multiple uses up there.
Correct. And that's why we
want to. As long as there's multiple uses, I think that's.
Well, that's why we want the turf. The turf tee pads is so that we can make sure we can put multiple.
Okay. So that would be like turf, like artificial.
Yeah, artificial grass.
Okay.
And like I said, starting with 9 holes, it won't take as long to put in, things like that, right? It'll be a lot faster process to start out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And only doing, not doing the concrete use, or concrete tee pads, the only concrete work we have to do is for the baskets themselves.
Okay.
Fine.
And it's
easy.
Okay. Thanks for the
information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is Historic Preservation Draft Ordinance and Commission Update, McKay and Mary.
I'm a lot McKay do most of the talking, so if he wants to. I can start, yes. We had a Historical Preservation Commission meeting. When did we have it, McKay?
Last week.
We have an excellent group in that. We have got Nikki Covington, who has not only historical preservation experience, but he is an artist, of course, and has a lot of amazing contacts with the art community. Of course, we've got Shannon Miller, who has restored multiple historic homes here. We've got Kate Crane, who is the Daughters of Utah Pioneers representative on the committee, who, of course, is the DUP takes care of the patent house for the museum for tours and things. And then Terry Spolino, who lives in one of the homes that Shannon restored, but he also worked for years with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the historical department in Nauvoo and back east and over several of the historical sites. So, and then of course we've got McKay, who's got lots of good experience, so anyway.
It was a really good meeting.
And they're very enthusiastic,
yes,
about what we can do in Manti to use the history that we have and to increase like economic development and tourism and everything.
So I presented to the city council last month about becoming a certified local government and making a National Historic Register area. And that's their first priority right now as a commission, is to become certified. That should hopefully be happening very, very soon. The first thing that we need to do for that is you all need to pass an ordinance for it, which they've given us, the state has given us language that I modified for Manti. It's in your packet, but I'll pull it up here. So the language here is really basic. It's just stating that we're a certified local government again, which we were certified in the past, so it's not going to be a big issue to be recertified. We just needed the commission, which we have now stated. So I believe in your next meeting next month, you'll be ratifying this language, but today was just for you all to look over it and if you have any questions for Mary or I.
Do we need to do anything in terms of approving the goals?
The goals is what the other thing that Mary and I wanted to run past you. So, for example, the Planning Commission.
Kind of get your blessing on them.
Yes. For the Planning Commission, they have goals that are usually dictated by the City Council. These are the goals that the Preservation Commission came up with themselves. And if you have any changes, reach out to Mary, Ives, or I. But let me just go over them really quickly. They have three main overarching goals. And the commission also is doubling as the Historic Preservation Committee for the general plan. And so these are their goals for the general plan as well. So the main things is connect funding for historic property upkeep and preservation for residents. The first thing I noticed is we have a lot of historic properties and a lot of people that can't afford to keep them up. So this one is directly connected to that National Historic Register area goal we have there. That's kind of what those 3 points are, along with informing residents of, there's Preservation Utah nonprofit who I'm with, that have loans to help with those kind of buildings. Their second main overarching goal is to preserve slash promote not just buildings but culture and ideas from our heritage. And they want to help create and support some traditional farmers market next year. They, through Preservation Utah, they have suggested they need tours all throughout Utah of historic properties. They have reached out to us and said they want to do a barn tour since we have so many wonderful historic barns here, and a historic horse tour once a year that wouldn't rival or compete with Spring City but complement. Updated materials for historic preservation, better utilize our Pioneer Heritage Gardens across from the temple by creating a program events there, hosting local mural artist competition for Main Street buildings as well. It's another thing they want to promote local heritage. And these are all, you know, aspirational goals, and that can be changed. Their last thing is protect and promote local businesses. It's a little unorthodox for a historic preservation commission to work on economic things, but they realized in their meeting that everything is very connected. If we promote our Main Street and help that get better and preserve well, that will also help local businesses. So there's a few things in there. Any questions so far?
I have one.
Yes.
So for the Pioneer Heritage Gardens, and I don't even know if this would fit into this or not, whatever you talk about program events. Palisades, as we know, last year they put up Christmas lights and they now have a destination, right, where people in Sanpete can go. I've just always thought that the Pioneer Heritage Garden would be just so beautiful if it was lit up with Christmas lights on the trees. It'd be a place for families to go, bring their children. You're at the foothills of the temple. I think it would also bring other people in because, you know, families in other communities are always looking for places, you know, to go and to enjoy the Christmas lights. So is that something that could be part of that?
That's exactly what they're hoping for. I'll inform them. That's a great idea.
Sweet.
Also, Preservation Utah did come down and they did a tour down here in Sanpete on July.
The end of July.
I think they came down, and it was the first time a lot of them had been down here. Most of them live up in the Wasatch Front. We went out to Thomas Grocery out in Sterling, and then we came over and we toured this Salinas home here, and then we went up to Spring City and toured several homes up there. They were very, very impressed with Nanti and with the preservation and just the location and all the historic homes that are in the area. They had no idea that all of this was available. So they were very, very impressed, I think.
And these are the top historic preservationists in the state, which now are very eager to be involved with helping us. So they have a lot of resources for us, which is really great.
Yeah. So it was very positive experience with that.
So Mayor, to answer your question, you don't need a formal motion for this, but if you have any concerns or problems and changing their direction as a council, let us know.
Thank you. All right, we will move on if there are no more comments or questions to continuing business. At our next meeting in September, we will be correcting a city ordinance that dropped the rear yard accessory buildings capacity. We'll do a public notice 2 weeks before the September council meeting for that. We talked about the parks, paths, and trails with Luke. Anything you want to add about the master plan update?
Tomorrow there is an open house at 7:30. In the old city hall on the second floor. It's going to be, I presented to the council already existing conditions analysis, but this is more of an informal open house to talk with residents about that, if they have questions or concerns. Additionally, there will be another open house next month, or at the end of this month, about the actual goals of the plan, the kind of the actual meat of the plan. So that if residents had input for those, please come to that open house and voice your.
I hope we're getting some good participation. What about the survey?
The survey also, we just finished with the Eagle Scout project. We went and knocked about 500 doors.
Wow.
Over the course of quite a few hours. They did a great job. Those scouts did a great job. So we're looking about average responses so far. I'm hoping to go above average if we can. So I'm going to be out knocking doors still. So please open your doors to me. It's hot outside.
Or rain.
Yes.
So is there QR code to take that on the city website?
There is.
Okay. Yes. So Manti.gov, and then where do they go?
They under the government's tab. There is a
general plan tab.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. There's a general plan tab that is the whole dedicated website page for the general plan, which includes the QR code.
So they haven't filled out the survey yet.
Okay, please do. Everybody in this room has
really
mostly has. But
it's super easy.
Tell your friends.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just a reminder again, this E911 rural health tax that will be coming on the ballot.
Yeah.
Please speak with your friends, neighbors, whatever, to make sure that they'll be supportive of that. Because if we don't vote for that, we will be paying more.
Yes, quite a bit more. The county commission is due to adopt that resolution at 2 o'clock on August 18th. And that starts the ball rolling for 75 days
to get it on the ballot.
So just make sure that whoever you talk to, that they know that that's something we need to support, because if it doesn't pass, it will be worse for everyone, especially those of us that are living in cities. The September meeting will also go over the wildland-urban interface known as WUI, and that'll be reviewed on the September 9th meeting. And then we already discussed the historical preservation ordinance will be reviewed and approved on the 9th.
I did notice on the WUI map that we had, it in the part that's in the WUI area is very small. That's within the boundaries of Manti City. There's a very, very little bit on the southeastern corner and then the eastern, the very, very eastern part. But most of it is in the National Forest Service.
And I will say, that is kind of just a draft. We can actually add more to that WUI area if we'd like to. They kind of left it up to us on that. So we're working on that. Hopefully by that September before then, you'll see a lot of data.
Okay. All right. Anything else on that? We will then move to council member reports. Brian, anything?
I don't have anything more than I've already said tonight.
All right. Jen?
Give a shout out to our Temple Ridge campground again. We married attended the chamber luncheon, and they honored the Temple Ridge campground, RV campground out there, but they received the $20,000 economic development grant from Tempe County, but they praised the chamber's help in helping them obtain that grant up and down. So more kudos to the chamber, but also kudos to our campground. And we're very excited for the
they've got plans, improvements
out there. So
they've already made some nice changes.
Big boost for Manti.
Mary,
how many of us are going to the League conference? Because we need to get registered for that. End of October. Yeah, it's October. Hang on, I'll give you the dates. It is October 27th and 28th. Salt Lake.
Yeah, put me down for it.
I figure we need to get that registered because
right.
The cost goes up the middle of September. So.
Yeah. We want to get the lower rate for
right.
sure.
I did tune in yesterday, the 11th, the National League of Cities and Towns did a 21st Century Road and Housing Act overview. This is the first comprehensive housing act that's been passed by Congress in decades. Hopefully it's going to provide flexibility with current programs that exist for helping people get into homes, including the home program and the CDBG programs. They talked about, you know, what it does. It basically provides blueprint for places, not a mandate, but it does make some changes to hopefully make it easier for smaller, for more affordable housing to actually happen. And in a lot of areas, it's cities and things where they need apartment buildings and multifamily housing and things like that. But it was a really, really good thing to listen to, and he said what they're going to be grants available for cities to help with infrastructure. They'll be working, and they did say again, partnership, not preemption. There's, if anybody's interested, you can go to NLC for National League of Cities, nlc.org/road-to-housing, and there's lots of information about that there. And then, I think that's all I have. Oh, we did go to the Daniel Buckley Funk,
good job,
Legacy of Modern Education. AJ and Mary and I were there. And it was fascinating to think that this man came in the mid-1800s, and he and his four sons made Palisade Lake with horses, mules, and scrapers. Like, they didn't have backhoes and stuff. They did it with mule power and horsepower. And that was his, you know, his vision was to have that beautiful lake. And of course, it helps for irrigation. It helps for, of course, the state park. Right now, it's a little empty because apparently the reason that it's leaking is because years ago, he planted trees all the way around the lake. Well, some of those trees are 120 years old now, and they have deteriorated, and as they have gone back to Mother Earth, they have created voids, and the water is seeping through those voids and out where it should ought to go. So they're going to fix that. And that's why Palisade is empty right now. So it will be coming back.
If we get more rain.
It'll go back.
Megan?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We will now open it up for public comment. If you would care to make public comment, please provide your name and state resident or non-resident, and limit it to 2 minutes, please. So you're welcome to come to the podium.
Hi, Rose Hatch, resident. I just came back from a trip to Alaska along the way to Victoria in Vancouver Island. And if you want to get an idea, of course this is order scale greater, but to see gardens at night in light, it gives you an idea, and it's just like very hard. Anyway, on another issue, I guess you know that I'm a member of the Constitution Party. I'm very conscientious and aware of, you know, constitutional rights for everyone here. And I talked to the council a few weeks ago about my concerns with flock cannabis. And I don't know if you looked at that information, but there are some very serious issues with the data collection going on with flock cannabis. And in fact, a lot of the communities that have adopted flock cannabis have said, no more, get it away. We've got legislators that are putting in controls in it nationally because of the overreach that's going on. I was very concerned when I saw a flock camera right next to here in City Hall, just down the street from the Main Street Pizza. And I'm just wondering what's going on with that, and I just don't know if you're aware of what's going on. I know that Sheriff's Department has several vehicles that have mobile apparatuses that can do the same sort of thing of data collection. So I have some concerns about it. Deep concerns. I have some information for your review if you'd like to look at or not look at. But I have several articles that I can share with you and give you some of the ideas about what's going on. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Here's one for AJ when he returns. And if you like, Kenny, you can have a copy of that too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. I just want you to kind of look at that and see what's going on.
Thank you.
Transportation. I wanted to talk to you about the Motorola license plate reader that the San Pete County Sheriff has put into Manti. They also have a mobile one that's going into whichever vehicle they choose, and so we never know where it's at or when we are being surveilled. And this is just teaching you about the Fourth Amendment effects. And June 29th of 2026, so just recently, the Supreme Court said it invaded Carpenter's reasonable expectation of privacy in the whole of his physical movements. I think you will find as you read through what Russ gave you, and as you read through this, you will see that this is a huge violation of our Fourth Amendment rights, and we intend to invoke everything that we can do to stop this from surveilling people who are not criminals, and they have no reason to be surveilled. And we would like the city council and the mayor to tell the sheriff to get it out of our city. And I have 38 signatures so far that I will be sending to you, and we will be gathering more, and we hope that you'll take it seriously because this is a Fourth Amendment violation. Thank you.
Did you state your name and residence?
To take a minute, Helen Thurston from Manti, and I am totally opposed to the flock cameras, and I'm representing my family, the Thurstons, and I would say nearly 100% of the people at our prep meeting the other night. Thank you, everyone. Oh, I want to say that in my country, it's not deer that we have a problem with, it's kangaroos.
It could be
worse.
Is there anyone else that would care to make public comment?
Howdy, Nate Brown, resident. Just two things. There was some controversy on Facebook a month back about the sidewalks. I believe it might have been McKay who put out a response, and I really appreciated the way the city handled that. I thought that was an excellent way not to engage but to get information out, so I really appreciated that. The other thing, just because it came up tonight, I am an avid disc golfer. I've been doing it since the early 90s. Brian, if you ever need somebody to go with, I would love to come. Spend a lot of time on the Ephraim course, and yeah, it'd be great to have one here. And I'll echo that the trails, the walking, the biking, and the disc golfers, it's part of the DNA of the disc golf community to really embrace all of that, because what we want is everybody to have a place where they can go. So disc golfers are used to waiting for people to clear. And it's a great place to take kids and grandkids. So that's all.
Thank you.
Oh. Since I still have 30 seconds, and I have a disc golf basket on my property, so if anybody wants to try it, feel free to come over and you can give it a shot.
I have one too. We can go between our rooms.
Par 64.
Is there anyone else that would like to make public comment? All right, seeing none, I will move to my comments. I attended the LPC Housing and Land Use Advisory Subgroup this afternoon, and they were talking about some of the issues that they're pretty sure will come up with the state legislature again, and you probably heard the same thing, Mary. Impact fees.
Yeah.
There's an audit that is going to be done prior to the legislative session to see how cities are using impact fees, and I guess they want to make sure that we're doing it to improve the infrastructure. The reason we have impact fees for new development is because we believe the burden should not fall on the current citizens to make an additional water tanks, bigger pipes for the sewer system, that sort of thing. the development that is causing a need for more infrastructure should be paying for that, and that's why we have impact fees. This doesn't really apply to us, but it was interesting to me that several HOA organizations where they made their own roads and whatnot, developments did their own roads so they didn't have to apply to the city standards.
Yeah, right.
Then they now want the cities to take it on. They said, one of the men on the call who is a city planner, he said, you just put an overlay structure on them and tell them they're going to pay for it one way or another. You're not going to have the other citizens pay for it. So they had some good approaches for dealing with that. But one of the other things that was interesting is building inspection is going to come up again because builders are pushing to have their own building inspectors, which is one of those fox guarding the hen house issues. So I'm sure with all the people that are in the legislature who are builders that it will come up again. They're also talking about using AI for permitting, which was interesting to me. Annexation was the other one, and the funds that are available, you mentioned that, Mary, for housing infrastructure. Evidently, Harriman received funds for smaller owner-occupied homes. Because one of the problems when zoning has tried to make more affordable and they made smaller lots, then people just built bigger houses on the tiny lots. So and still we're charging, you know, $600,000-$700,000. Just a reminder, the UMPA summer social is next week in Spanish Fork if anyone's able to go. I don't have anything else. And I don't believe we need to have a closed session today. So
not unless you guys do.
With that, I will accept a motion to adjourn.
I will make a motion that we adjourn and take the fund bill.
I will second that one.
Motion made by Mary Pipe, seconded by Francois. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Oh, I want to stay here another hour. Thank you so much for coming. We appreciate your attendance this evening and your interest in the affairs of the city. And we appreciate you coming, Sheriff Buchanan. Thank you.
Yeah. I got that speech here. I don't know if you guys are ready.